Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pot is on the ballot in six states next week. Marijuana for medical use in Massachusetts, Montana, Arkansas. And marijuana for a buzz, recreation, in Colorado, Washington, Oregon. For the first time ever, those three states could make it completely legal to have a toke for the sole purpose of getting stoned. To some, that sounds fine. To others, that sounds like a problem. This hour on Point, marijuana on the ballot. You can join the conversation. Are you shaking your head, wondering how this can be, or wondering why it's taken so long to make it legal to smoke a joint? How will you, how would you vote? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we'll get the latest on tallying up the economic toll and more of Hurricane Sandy. But first, marijuana on the ballot. Joining me now from Pittsburgh is Jonathan Calkins, professor of operations research and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. He's watching the whole pot picture across the country. He's co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know, the book. Jonathan Calkins, thank you very much for being with us.
No, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So help us understand the current scene now. Before we go to the polls, next Tuesday, what is the status of marijuana use, legal marijuana use across the country? Is it really 17 states now that offer, that have medical marijuana as legal?
17 jurisdictions, one being Washington, D.C. Yes, of course, they vary enormously. Some of them, notably California and Colorado, make it quite easy to get a recommendation, and they have dispensaries. Others of the 17 restrict the recommendations to people who have a very serious disease, and they don't include dispensaries. So there's a range.
Okay. And what do we know about marijuana as a product sold in this country overall? Does anybody know how much marijuana is sold in the United States of America, the dollar value of annual sales?
Call it 5,000 metric tons and $15 to $20 billion in round terms.
Okay, a lot. So we've got some that's legal already, California, Colorado, dispensaries, and the works. Next week, what's on the ballot, Jonathan?
Sure. I am really glad that you're drawing this sharp distinction between the medical marijuana and the propositions in Washington, Oregon, and Colorado, because they're very different. But they're very different on two dimensions. Mm-hmm. One is whether you need a medical recommendation or not. But the other is whether it pertains just to the possession and retail sale or also large-scale commercial for-profit production. What would be legalized in Washington, Oregon, and Colorado is not just personal use for recreation,
okay,
but a commercial industry to produce it in bulk quantities and make money as a large scale.
In other words, marijuana farms would be legal under these proposed laws, referenda in those states?
The key word is in those states. Of course, the Federal Controlled Substances Act would remain in force, and it remains in force even for medical users now. So even the medical marijuana has only been legalized with respect to state and local law, never with respect to the Federal Controlled Substances Act.
Yeah, I want to look at how states and the federal government would interact on this. But take us to Colorado, Washington State, Oregon. What exactly? Are the referenda the same? If they're not, tell us the differences. But what exactly would they make legal? What's the structure that they lay out?
Sure. Washington and Colorado are a little bit more alike, so mention those together. They both envision a three-tiered structure. So there's the producers, processors, retailers, all free market. Those entities would be licensed and regulated, but they would just be free market operations. Oregon is different. Oregon's proposition, which seems to be the least likely to pass, would actually have the government running the retail stores, not just regulating them.
So the government would sell marijuana in Oregon if this was passed?
Well, perhaps. So you made reference to the conflict with federal law. There's a notion of preemption. If a state law positively conflicts with the federal law, it is can be preempted by a judge, and it's as if it hadn't passed. You could guess that the state operating a store that would be preempted if Oregon passed. Whereas one would guess that the mere regulation and licensing might well not be preempted because that already happens with medical marijuana.
So in Colorado then, in Washington, let's take it from the producer out to the consumer, if that's the right word. I guess it would be here.
Yep.
You would have legal production, illegal farms of marijuana. You would have legal, what, packagers and distributors of marijuana. Then where would it be sold in those states? In, I don't know, in liquor stores or where?
Washington, it would just be stores that sold only marijuana products.
Okay.
Their sole purpose. And the processors may be doing something more than just packaging because it may be, quote-unquote, bundled with other products. So marijuana brownies, marijuana-infused beers, you could have candy.
Oh, okay, like yeah, we can imagine a proliferation of different manifestations, presentations of marijuana there.
Exactly, because legalization would put downward pressure on basic marijuana as an intoxicant. So the producers may well want to find their niche or their way of differentiating.
Okay, and retail in Colorado, what is that envisioned to look like?
You'll have marijuana stores, yeah. Now, the question is how much of this you can really do flagrantly. If a nation legalized, then you could have a genuine farm with tractors and combines. That's how industrial hemp is harvested
yeah.
in places like Canada and China and Europe now. Presumably, that's not going to happen if only a state legalizes because a farm is worth millions of dollars. It's a big visible target that's easy to see.
You mean so it'd be legal but still kind of hidden in what, grow houses and what?
That's a good guess. Yeah, I mean, one of the things
to
stress is no one knows for sure how this will play out. But one guess is that the DEA agents would come and seize the property of anybody operating really brazenly. Big sign out front, everybody can see it.
Yeah.
But maybe if it's a grow house and the house from the outside doesn't look any different than any other residence, there might be a real problem with federal agents breaking into a house, a residence, to arrest people for something that state's voters had approved.
I get it. Hold that issue. I mean, I realize in the end these two will collide or meet at the very least, but take us on through the picture because this is all kind of news to me, I must say, and I'm guessing a lot of other people. So you're in Colorado. Polls say this is likely to pass. We don't know, but it's likely at this point. On the other side, we have stores opening up, and you go into that store, how much marijuana could you buy under this law?
Well, this is where the quantity limits are there. The amounts that the individual could purchase at any given moment is an ounce or less. Now, Colorado actually has potentially a bit of a loophole here. Colorado's proposition bans the store from collecting the ID of the person buying. So there really isn't much of a way to stop somebody from making multiple purchases in Colorado.
It also means this would be sort of like fireworks stores. People from any state could come in and buy. Right?
I think it's true that at the moment, neither proposition requires residence for the customers. So you could have some drug tourism. Yeah, and in fact, one of the things that's a little funny about the debate is, of course, the potential tax revenues is one of the big appeals, and the folks producing the estimates of tax revenues imagine that only people inside the state are going to be buying, which is probably pessimistic from a tax revenue perspective.
And is the tax rate set on this? Is it seen to be a potential significant source of tax revenue?
The tax rates are set. In Colorado, it's pretty simple to describe. It's 15% of the wholesale price on the non-medical, which is quite low. Right? 15% isn't a big tax. The wholesale price is below the retail price. And
compared to cigarettes, for example, it's very low, right?
It's very low. Washington, in many respects, is a more restrictive approach. It has three different 25% levies, at the three different levels of the market. So that adds up to a more substantial tax.
Hey, Jonathan, you've been looking at this for a long time. Is this some kind of tipping point we're coming up on here? I mean, I'm looking, again, who knows how people are going to vote next week. Massachusetts looks likely to vote for medical marijuana. Montana, we don't know. That's a complicated scene. Arkansas looks likely to vote against if the polls are correct. Now, in these other three, Colorado, Washington, very likely to legalize this wider, freer use. Oregon, maybe not. But if Colorado and Washington sort of take the reins off here and say, okay, off you go, is this some kind of tipping point for marijuana's place and role in our country, Jonathan?
I think that's a great word to use. No, of course, almost by definition, tipping points are hard to know for sure whether you're hitting one. But I think that's the metaphor to have in mind. This really was sort of unthinkable even 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Not that no one thought about it or wanted it, but for the median voter to possibly be voting for it, it's a big change. And people observe that the public is far more supportive, roughly half of Americans now support legalization, than, say, Congress. So there's a big divide there, but Congress may come around relatively quickly once states move forward. The other tipping point phenomenon is how other countries react around the world, because traditionally much of the world has seen the United States as a leader in pushing the current international treaty regime. Some countries have balked at that, but they've been hesitant because they feared U.S. response. But if the U.S. has states that have legalized, that may give other countries the perception that they can move out of the international treaty regime.
And I'm reading here that the Colorado referendum would create, in fact, looser rules than Holland, looser than Amsterdam. Telluride and Denver and Colorado Springs. This would be something to see, and it will all be voted on next week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about marijuana on the ballot in six states next week, three for medical use, Massachusetts, Montana, Arkansas, and three for pretty much complete legalization, Colorado, Washington State, Oregon. We've been talking with Jonathan Calkins from Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon University, a co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to have the debate in just a minute. Lots of TV ads out there in the states where this is on the ballot. Here's an ad against former Colorado governors Bill Ritter and Bill Owens describing the dangers of legalizing marijuana in this radio ad paid for by Smart Colorado, which is leading the campaign to stop legalization of marijuana, a recreational use in Colorado.
Marijuana abuse accounts for 67% of the adolescents in substance abuse treatment programs in the United States.
And history has shown that the number of marijuana users aged 12 to 25 could double if we make marijuana easier for kids to access.
And we can certainly agree that legalizing marijuana has no place in our state's constitution.
So please join me and Governor Ritter and hundreds of elected officials, business leaders, and law enforcement officials
and vote no on 64.
It's bad for our kids,
and it's wrong for Colorado.
Two former Colorado governors there saying no. Here's the other side. An ad posted to YouTube just this month by the nonprofit Wake Up and Legalize It. Here, former federal law enforcement officials were told endorse Washington State's marijuana legalization initiative.
We know firsthand that decades of marijuana arrests have failed to reduce use, and the drug cartels are pocketing all the profits.
Initiative 502 brings marijuana under tight regulatory control. 502 generates new revenue for education, healthcare, and prevention.
And if 502 passes, we'll have more resources to go after violent crime. Join us in voting yes on 502.
Pro and con on legalizing pot. They're in First Colorado and also Washington State. Jonathan Calkins, please stand by in Pittsburgh. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from Washington, Dr. Robert Bob DuPont, co-chair of the Writing Group on Marijuana and fellow at the American Society of Addiction Medicine. He was the first director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse back in the 1970s. He was the second White House drug czar, 1973 to 77. Dr. DuPont, Bob DuPont, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be with you.
And with us from Washington is Rob Campia. He's co-founder and executive director of the Marijuana Policy Project. They sponsored signature drives, paid for advertising to support ballot measures in Arkansas and Colorado to legalize medical and recreational use in Colorado of marijuana. In the last 12 months, his group has received donations from 8,000 supporters. Rob Campia, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Rob, first to you, what do you think is likely to pass out of this half dozen marijuana referenda initiatives?
The Massachusetts Medical Marijuana Initiative is guaranteed to pass. I think we have a very good shot at passing the Colorado and the Washington legalization initiatives. The polling in both states is consistently good, but they're not guaranteed. And then Montana and Oregon and Arkansas are much tougher battles.
What's your ultimate goal here? I mean, 17 states with medical marijuana use already, California and more with pretty liberal medical marijuana use. Now recreational use on the ballot in three states. Your group has been instrumental in pushing this. What's your ultimate goal?
The ultimate goal is to change federal law so that states will be able to determine their own marijuana policies without federal interference. And then in addition to that, we want to change all 50 state laws so that marijuana is regulated similarly to alcohol.
Why is this your goal?
Quite simply, the prohibition of marijuana hasn't worked. It hasn't succeeded at its goal. The whole point of prohibiting marijuana back many decades ago was to prevent adults and especially to prevent teenagers from using marijuana. But anyone who's lived in this country for more than a few months knows that prohibition is not preventing adults or teenagers from using marijuana. If this was any other government program, it would have been shut down a long time ago. This program called Prohibition simply is not working, and it's time for a new approach.
Bob DuPont, prohibition of marijuana hasn't worked, says Rob. It's time to shut it down. What do you say, sir?
Well, let's think about this. It hasn't worked. It's an interesting point. If you look at how the drug use of Americans 12 and older, if we look at alcohol, and the question is, what percentage of Americans 12 and older have used a particular drug in the last 30 days, even once? The answer for alcohol is 51%, for tobacco is 27%, and for marijuana is 7%. Now, how can you figure that that's not working? It clearly is reducing the use compared to what would happen if you treated marijuana like we treat alcohol and tobacco. I think the question is, what would our country look like if we had 27% or 51% of Americans 12 and older smoking marijuana? That's what we're looking at if we legalize marijuana.
Well, fill in that blank. You're a former drug czar, so we can kind of picture where you'll come from. But let's say it goes to a quarter of the population in the last month has used marijuana a few years down the road. If these referenda continue to go through and somehow states and federal government find an accommodation here, what would that look like in your view?
Well, this current movement toward marijuana liberalization and tolerance of marijuana use is premised on the idea that marijuana use is basically harmless, that it's a trivial health threat. And this is not even close to true. The statistics that I find particularly compelling are of all Americans with a dependence or abuse problem with any drug other than alcohol, 61% are in that category because of marijuana. It's the major cause of drug abuse in the United States right now as a health problem. And to take another example of highway safety, in a study in Maryland of drivers treated the shock trauma unit for very serious injuries found that 28% of them had marijuana as a major factor in their accident. This compared to 32% for alcohol. So marijuana was almost as big as alcohol.
Well, right. This gets us into interesting, tricky territory because we all know alcohol can have pretty deleterious health effects as well, and yet it's sold all over the place. Tobacco, deleterious effects, and yet it's got – and there it is in some kind of middle ground with restrictions and yet legal to smoke. Why apply a different standard to marijuana, sir?
I think what the public health goal is to reduce all of those problems, and legalization is going to increase it. You mentioned, Tom, that I was the co-chair of the writing committee for the American Society of Addiction Medicine. Mm. This is the national organization of physicians who specialize in treating addiction and preventing addiction. We recently had a white paper exercise for the organization and came out with a very clear statement that we oppose the legalization of marijuana and we oppose the medical marijuana initiatives, because both of them are going to increase the use, and that's going to increase dependence and problems in the country. This is in the face of the fact that the doctors make their living treating people, and, of course, raising the use would increase the business for the doctors.
Well, yeah,
and the treatment
everybody's
programs.
Got some kind of interest here. Rob Campia, what about, A, the health threat, and, B, the safety threat, highway safety threat, if your goal should come to pass?
Well, we have our highway safety threats with regard to alcohol use, marijuana use, use of prescription medicines, people who just work the double shift and they're sleepy at the wheel.
Right. But the point here is, I mean, do you accept that marijuana use would rise, as Bob DuPont suggests, if it were legal, from 7% to something closer to alcohol use?
I'm not sure, and because we've never done this before in the history of the world in terms of full legalization, so
but
I don't know if marijuana would
rise. But it seems reasonable to assume that it would rise by some significant amount, right, if it were just in a package store.
If it rises and it causes fewer adults to drink alcohol, that would actually be a good thing for our society, because marijuana has obviously, it's not physically addictive, it's impossible to overdose on it, it doesn't cause liver damage. And furthermore, marijuana is not associated with violence in our society. Alcohol is associated with sexual assault, bar fights, domestic violence, and so forth. And marijuana is not associated with any of that. So if marijuana use does increase in the U.S., what I'm saying is that wouldn't even necessarily be a bad thing if some adults were shifting from alcohol to marijuana. I do want to say one thing about Holland, though, is while it is true what Bob DuPont said about fewer adults using marijuana than alcohol in the U.S., that's clearly true. But there's another comparison to be made, which is marijuana being used in the U.S. versus Holland. The usage rates in Holland amongst teenagers as well as adults is actually lower than in the U.S. So that what that shows is that the prohibition regime of marijuana in the U.S. is doing not as much good as the pseudo-regulatory regime in Holland in terms of making marijuana less interesting for, let's say, teenagers to use.
Jonathan Calkins in Pittsburgh, jump in here. You've looked at this across a very wide spectrum. What's the right prism to bring to this? Is it a health, public health and safety lens that we should put on this? Is it something about freedom, justice, fairness? If you can drink alcohol, why not have a joint? What's the right prism to bring to this, Jonathan?
Yes, all. I don't know why you have to choose. I will amplify the point that if you're thinking about this from a public health perspective, it all depends on how this affects alcohol use and smoking. If a big increase in marijuana use means much less heavy drinking, that's a public health win. If the big increase in marijuana use complements and supplements alcohol, so alcohol, or for that matter, even smoking goes up, it's a loss. And the science on that is completely agnostic. We simply do not know whether on net, when you do something like legalize marijuana, it will lead to more or less consumption.
You mean if it draws down some alcohol, but it increases some smoking lung problems off of pot? You don't know what the net is.
I think we do know.
If alcohol went down a lot,
yeah,
that would probably be a win relative to the smoking problems from the cannabis itself.
Bob DuPont, but what do you say to that?
Marijuana use led to more people smoking tobacco.
Yeah.
The problems with tobacco and alcohol are so large that changes in either of those could swamp the outcomes that are marijuana specific. And I'm just saying that we have no way to know how marijuana legalization would affect consumption of either alcohol or tobacco. There's an optimistic, hopeful story, but you can also tell a pessimistic story.
Let me tell a kind of simple story about that. We do know about that. This is one of the illusions that has been promoted, used for the promoters of marijuana for a long time. We know that marijuana users have higher rates of drinking and higher rates of smoking than people who don't smoke marijuana. So that the increase of that population would definitely increase.
So you don't think it'll be a substitution effect, but rather
it absolutely has never been a substitution, and it's very clear. These drugs are, the use of them is totally related to each other. That's people who drink are more likely to smoke marijuana, and the people who smoke marijuana are more likely to drink, for example. So increasing the marijuana users in the population would absolutely increase the use of smoking and alcohol.
What about the fairness issue, Bob? You can have your whiskey. He can't have his pot. Is that fair?
Well, to take the fairness issue, take it over to OxyContin, Tom, and think about that. What do you think about, you know, I like to use OxyContin, you like to use alcohol. Why is that fair? I think that you've got to realize that, that marijuana is the camel's nose for a whole lot of drugs, not just this one. And the same arguments come up about all of them. We've got very big markets
yep.
For cocaine, very big markets for the opiates in the country. And the idea that somehow we're going to reduce those problems and raise revenue by making them legally available is just a horrifying concept in terms of the public health.
Rob, I'll bring that to you, but I want to get our callers in. So many waiting to come. Savannah, Georgia. Clay is calling. Hi, Clay. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I had a very simple question that nobody seems to want to answer or be able to answer, okay. And it's quite simply, let's say I am a Colorado resident and they pass this along.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sitting there in my front porch and I'm smoking a joint and my local county or state police are doing their neighborhood watch and drive by. What happens next? I mean, do they just drive on? Do they,
yeah.
You know, yes. Did they get out, engage me, or am I arrested?
Yeah, I think it's hard for people to picture. Jonathan Calkins, paint that picture. You're on your porch, or hey, you're in a public park, and you're smoking a joint on the other side of, let's say, the passage of this legislation, and a policeman walks by. What happens, Jonathan? Anything? Nothing?
Something? The short answer should be nothing. There is the capacity for these propositions to differentiate between use in public and use in private. But no, that is the notion of legalization, is that the state and local police would no longer be enforcing marijuana prohibition laws.
It would be legal. It would be straight up legal. And I guess, Clay, that's a pretty straightforward answer. We'll come again to the federal issue here, but let me get one more. Tyler in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Tyler, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what's your question?
Well, I previously lived in Washington State where medical marijuana has been legal for some time, and that law allowed for dispensaries but didn't do a great job of spelling out how they were permitted. And so local law enforcement would shut them down, then they would allow them to open again, then they would shut them down, and it ended up being a real chaotic system. And I was curious how well-written your guests thought the ballot initiatives in Washington and Colorado were with respect to how they would legalize sale. Is this a good system? Would it be clear for everyone to understand?
Yeah, solid and clear in legal terms. Rob, you've been instrumental in getting some of these referenda on the ballot. What about it? Are these clear, straightforward, sort of ironclad laws, or are you going to have people dickering over what's legal even after they're in effect, if they go?
No, these initiatives that we drafted are quite clear, and they're much different from the Washington medical marijuana law that the caller just referenced, which was passed in 1998. That law did not actually say anything about dispensaries. And so there were some entrepreneurs who decided they wanted to call themselves dispensaries, but they did not actually have any license to do so from the state government. The Colorado and Washington initiatives that are going to be on the ballot in 6 days are actually licensing systems. So they actually say that if you jump through a bunch of hoops and you pay the government some money and you have a good business plan, that you can obtain a license to either grow marijuana or package it or sell it at the retail level. And then you have to pay your excise taxes at some level and then the sales tax at some level.
And to Bob DuPont's,
it's very clear that each of these steps is licensed.
And to Bob DuPont's point, if let's say we go to marijuana, legal here in Colorado and beyond, what about the camel's nose argument that we've always heard? You know, next it'll be, I don't know, OxyContin. Next it'll be cocaine. Next it'll be, you name it, opiates. What do you say?
Well, OxyContin and opiates are already legal,
not Colorado style, not like under this referendum.
Well, not for recreational uses.
Right.
I don't know. We're not going to work on that. If someone wants to start running a cocaine legalization initiative, I'm guessing it would fail by a 95% to 5% margin.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about marijuana on the ballot in 6 states next week. 3 for medical use, Massachusetts, Montana, Arkansas, and 3 for complete legalization, recreational use, Colorado, Washington State, Oregon. Before we wrap in this hour, we're going to look at the mounting toll of Superstorm Sandy. But right now, it's marijuana. Jonathan Calkins is with us, author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Robert DuPont is with us from Washington, co-chair of the Writing Group on Marijuana. Robert Campia is with us, co-founder, executive director of the Marijuana Policy Project. They've been instrumental in pushing referenda in a number of states. In Arkansas, it's about medical marijuana. The ads are on there for and against. Here's one against. Funded by the Family Council Action Committee, showing young people lighting up and weighing bags of weed they plan to sell.
The proposed marijuana law? Don't kid yourself. It's really about making it easier to get illegal drugs. Prescriptions, pharmacies, not necessary. Almost anyone will qualify to grow, use, and distribute this dangerous drug. No professional healthcare oversight either. The grass growers and dope dealers will be in charge. Arkansas doesn't need a state filled with stoned-out zombies or the criminal activities that come from legalizing controlled substances. Say no to dope. Vote no to Issue 5.
Run for your lives. It's stoned out zombies coming. Here's a pro ad from the Marijuana Policy Project. Rob's group, a veteran here, a military veteran, explaining why he would like medical marijuana legalized.
I suffer from PTSD because I had 3 of my close friends lose their life in front of me. Doctors have recommended that marijuana would replace a lot of medications without the side effects that I'm suffering from now. I would like that to be an option for me. I want to get my life back. Veterans who have served their country should not be denied the opportunity to alleviate their suffering. Please vote yes on Issue 5.
There's the call for medical marijuana in Arkansas. 6 states looking half at medical marijuana, half at much broader use than that. Lots of response here online. Kathy writes at our website, "It's about time. I'm 60 years old, used it constantly through college, never led to anything stronger." For her. Here's another listener in Vermont says, 100% unrestricted, absolutely not. Medical, yes. He writes, or she writes, "We don't need more legal ways to screw up people's brains for recreation." Jonathan, I don't know where you come down on this one. Where are you on medical? Where are you on recreational use after looking at everything you have for your writing and work, Jonathan?
Oh, I do my very best not to be an advocate. I'm really just trying to inform, dispel myths, and help people reach their own conclusions.
Well, then, help us think about this. There's a lot of alcohol that goes down the hatch in this country and plenty of other drugs, legal and illegal. How do you think about the impact on the country overall? You know, we look back couple of centuries to China when they had a big opium problem, and it was, people look back on that and say, well, that was part of their, you know, it was a sign of real kind of a degraded moment in China's history. Do we risk that, or is that a too histrionic a way of looking at marijuana legalization here?
That might be a little bit too histrionic, but it is useful to think about what will and will not happen with other substances. And I apologize, I often say we can't know this, we can't know that. Let me tell you one thing we do know for sure, which is that even if marijuana were legalized and even at the national level, it wouldn't end the drug war. As Rob points out, marijuana is really not that associated with violence inside the United States. It's not what causes the overdose. It is not what fills the prisons. Less than 10% of the drug law violators are there for marijuana. It's not where most of the money is being spent.
Well, but we've seen the tunnels with the bales coming in from Mexico. We've seen Mexico a complete mess in big marijuana production and in our national parks.
Yeah, but it's really a myth that 60% of the Mexican drug trafficking organization's revenues come from marijuana. That's been...
So the drug war would still be on over cocaine and more, you're saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The big change would be that a lot of people who are now not getting put in prison would be put on the right side of the law, and that's not a small matter. But the drug war, most of what you think about is the drug war we continue, because most of that is about the cocaine, meth, and heroin.
Can you see a time when this would be as kind of straight ahead as a six-pack of Budweiser? I mean, here we've got a listener saying, "I wish there were more modern terms." She writes, "I mean, joint, toke, buzz, weed, ganja, baked, blunt, doobie, they all sound like painful remnants of..." This listener says that dirty hippie days of yore. Well, anybody can have their own view on hippie days, but I mean, can you picture a time when this is just all, you know, packaged up Budweiser style and part of the American, I don't know, weekend?
Yes. I think one of the – you spoke earlier of tipping point, and I think it's useful to think about other historical examples, like gambling at one time being shunned, now perfectly accepted. Gay marriage – not very long ago was sort of unthinkable, and it seems we're moving rapidly through a tipping point. And you can look across countries. Alcohol is unthinkable in a number of countries around the world, perfectly normal here. I do think that cultures can change in terms of what they think is thinkable or unthinkable. And marijuana poses a completely different order of health risk and threat than, say, cocaine does.
Let's go to Paul in Omaha, Nebraska. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
This is a little bit of a sideline or sidebar to the conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm not so much promoting one way or the other, but I'm a professional life insurance agent, and I know one of the things that catches a lot of people off guard is, you know, when we hear somebody is a social smoker, they smoke a cigarette or two at a bar or something like that.
Tobacco, yeah.
They're considered a nicotine user. Marijuana use is considered the same way. If you use marijuana, even if you're not a regular tobacco smoker, you are considered a nicotine user. That pushes your rates 2 to 3 times higher than the average person.
What if I have 2 less whiskeys a week? Would that make any difference in your calculus, Paul, or not?
We do not differentiate between a casual drinker, but we do identify problem drinkers. And so, you know, somebody who has DUIs caused by using marijuana,
yeah,
or somebody who is just a casual user of marijuana, they're going to see their insurance rates skyrocket.
Implications people may not have thought of here, and we'll keep it in mind. One more, David in Nashville, Tennessee. David, you're on the air.
Yes. Thanks, Tom.
Yes.
My wife has multiple sclerosis, MS.
Yeah.
We attend a number of MS support groups here in Nashville, and we hear frequently from very highly qualified neurologists, many of them from Vanderbilt University.
Mm-hmm.
Anecdotally, we hear from these same highly respected neurologists who do a lot of research, principally in the pharmaceutical area. We hear from them anecdotally that MS is effective for their clients, both for spasticity, pain.
Oh, you mean marijuana is effective for addressing MS pain, you're saying?
Not only pain,
mm-hmm,
pain, but spasticity, if you know the symptoms,
yeah,
of MS, multiple symptoms included beyond pain.
So our time is so short here, David, but for your wife and others, I guess I'm hearing you say, let's have access.
Well, I'm saying let's do research,
okay,
because it is not research in the systematic ways that other pharmaceuticals are. Principally, it is a no-starter because of federal regulations.
And you've got a very personal situation. I apologize, but I'm up against the clock here, David. But point made. Bob DuPont, what about from medical marijuana use? Do you support that?
No, but I think it's wonderful to look at the individual constituents of marijuana and identify those that have potential for medical uses and make them available as pharmaceutical products, just like we do other pharmaceutical products with a specific dose, with a prescription for a doctor, and buy it at a pharmacy.
Rob Campia, 10 years out, do you think we're going to have a different pot picture in this country?
Yeah, I think in 10 years you're going to see that the benefits of Colorado and Washington are going to spread to other states. You're going to have law enforcement focusing their time on real crimes instead of marijuana. You're not going to see people growing marijuana in public parks because you currently don't see people trying to grow grapes for wine in public parks. And you're going to see this importation of marijuana from Mexico go away because there'd be no need to import marijuana from Mexico if you can grow it domestically.
All eyes on those 6 states next week. Rob Campia, Bob DuPont, Jonathan Calkins, co-author of Marijuana Legalization. Thanks to all of you for being with us. In a moment, the still mounting impact of Hurricane Sandy, the economic toll. This is On Point. Hurricane Sandy and the superstorm it became have left a wide swath of destruction in its wake. From the Atlantic coast to the Great Lakes, infrastructure repairs and business disruptions will cost tens of billions of dollars, we're told. Gregory Dacko is senior economist for IHS Global Insight and joins us now from Lexington, Massachusetts. Gregory, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
So take these numbers apart with us for a second. We've seen a huge range. People were saying up to $50 billion, I think, overnight. What kind of range are you now sketching out here as the possible price tag of Sandy?
We're looking at total economic losses around $20 to $40 billion. It's still very early to give a fixed estimate as to how much damage was caused by the hurricane. But as of right now, we know that there are two types of damages, infrastructure damages and then business disruptions, disruptions to regular business activity.
Well, look at what you're including here. Rank this for us. I mean, I was reading yesterday. I'm sure there are many ways of calculating. I saw a $16 billion cost tag on Irene. I saw something like $100 billion price tag on Katrina. So at 20 to 40, would that make Sandy one of the costliest hurricanes ever?
It's likely to put Hurricane Sandy somewhere in the middle there in the top five most destructive hurricanes. As you mentioned, Katrina had damages worth around $120 billion. Irene, which hit us last year and had a similar trajectory but was a weaker storm and hit us on a Sunday instead of a Monday, had lower damages estimated around $15 billion. So Sandy with $20 to $40 billion in economic losses would be somewhere in the middle.
So let's say 20 to 40. That's a big range. 40, you know, twice as much. But
yep.
What are the major chunks that you put into that accounting? What are the big line items in whether it's 20 or 40? I assume the proportions would be about the same. What are the main line items?
Well, the first part is the infrastructure damage. The current estimates put infrastructure losses around $10 billion. The rule of thumb is that total infrastructure losses are around twice as much, so around $20 billion for total infrastructure.
And what does that mean? Is that railway tracks that are washed out and highway damage, or is that also, you know, the freezer down at Bob's Ice Cream Shack?
It incorporates a number of things, road, bridges that were damaged. It includes buildings that were damaged, any type of infrastructure that was damaged. It does not include disruptions to regular business activities. For that disruption, we're estimating the losses to be around, again, $10 to $20 billion. And that would incorporate your grocery store shutting down during the storm, not being able to open up because of flooding or power outages. So those are the two different types of damages.
And capital costs to a business, you know, I've got an ice cream shack by the beach and the freezer got washed over with salt water. Is that in your infrastructure item or in the business disruption side?
That would be in the business disruption side because that business will not be able to open its doors as it would regularly. It was probably shut on Monday and may be shut down for the rest of the week. So that is a disruption to economic activity. And that's what we look for when we're trying to estimate the impact on real GDP growth in the fourth quarter of this year.
Well, how does that work? Let's say there's $20 billion in infrastructure costs. Well, that $20 billion is going to be spent. So does that just, you know, snap right back and create the same amount of economic activity that it cost? Do you know what I mean? Somebody's going to fill in those potholes and charge money for that.
Yes, the infrastructure damage will lead to some reconstruction efforts, and usually that ends up, taking some time to actually be put in place. It's not tomorrow that all the damage will be repaired, so it will last a few months, maybe up into next year to repair some of the damage. So the rebuilding efforts are spread out across a longer period of time. The immediate damage from lost business activity is in the fourth quarter. Whereas the reconstruction efforts may last until the first quarter of this year.
So how much of the cost of a hurricane is a real net loss? I mean, does it even out if I come back and rebuild those roads or if I deliver the package, you know, a week late and get paid for the delivery then? How much is really and truly lost to the economy?
I think right now we're putting the real net loss to the economy in the fourth quarter of this year around 0.2 to 0.3 percentage points.
Of GDP?
Yes, growth. In terms of...
That's big when we've only got 1 or 2 or 2.5% growth.
That's true. When we have a very weak recovery like we're seeing right now, any minor disruption is not good. But again, we may see a little bit of a boost in the first quarter of this year if reconstruction efforts take place in that next quarter, or later in the next year if the weather is too severe during the winter and that reconstruction efforts are postponed until the spring of next year.
Now, you're saying $20 to $40 billion cost of this thing. That's a big swing. What are the big variables in that? What will determine whether it's 20 or twice as much?
Well, as you know, we're still very early after the storm. So it's going to take time to estimate the extent of infrastructure losses. It's also going to take time to put a correct estimate on the actual business disruptions that took place, how much stores might have lost. You were talking earlier about the ice cream shop whose fridge or freezer mm-hmm. might not have been working. It's going to take time to actually evaluate the total impact. So that's why we have currently a wide range.
We've got a genuine death toll and not an insignificant one in this superstorm, Sandy. But apart from that, when it comes to financial terms, who are the biggest losers here? Bring it down to people or businesses. Where's the biggest loser come?
You have losses across the board, across a number of different industries that make up today's economy. Trade flows were impacted, both on the import and export sides through shipments that didn't take place or may have been delayed. Individuals working in the construction sector were not able to work during the storm. They will be able to get back to work after the storm, and there may be some offset there. Manufacturing workers whose plants were shut down did not work during the storm. Retail stores also saw lower sales during the storm, but may see a boost after the storm as people go back to do their groceries.
Does it hurt that it hit the East Coast first? I mean, you had all the way out to big swells in Lake Michigan, but does it hurt the East Coast competitively vis-a-vis the rest of the country, or help it when they rebuild?
I think it's hurting the East Coast more than it's helping it because of it, of the fact that the hurricane hit a very populous and densely populated region with major cities like New York, Washington,
yeah.
and Boston.
Well, we're feeling the pain right now. Gregory Dayko with Global Insight joined us from Lexington, Massachusetts. Gregory, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Be safe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.